Hi, Alex.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Alex Massey in England, and you write a lot for a lot of people, notably including The Spectator, which might suggest to people that you are among those who is most kind of torn up about this this Margaret Thatcher thing. Maybe you're still in a period of grieving. I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously, I thought about white shirt, black tie for recording this, but I think I mean half the country's in mourning and the other half is celebrating.
Celebrating.
No, but
well, I mean, you're celebrating her legacy, right? To some extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think. I mean, Thatcher, what we've discovered, I think, anew in Britain today, or been reminded of this week, is just how consequential a prime minister she was, how she was not someone you could ignore. Tony Blair, like Margaret Thatcher, won 3 election victories, but Blair's legacy, at this stage anyway, will not be anything like as great. His impact on British politics was not anything like Margaret Thatcher's. In many ways, Blair was the heir to Thatcher. He accepted large parts of the Thatcherite settlement, and he didn't actually put Britain onto a new path particularly himself. In this respect, Blair was comparable in some ways to Bill Clinton, and Thatcher obviously is compared with Reagan in terms of their impact. But it's not just in Britain. You look at the front pages of newspapers around the world, and they're dominated by the news of Thatcher's death. And there are very few politicians anywhere in the world who get that sort of reaction upon their death. Whether it's in the United States, in France, in Germany, Argentina, even China, Thatcher's death was something that registered and on the front pages of newspapers all around the world in ways that that are unusual, especially in this day and age where Britain is not a particularly large country, but it was a measure of her international significance and reputation, her clout, whether for better or for worse, that she provoked this sort of reaction. I mean, she wasn't a politician you could ignore. You couldn't do that when she was alive, and as it turns out, you can't do it when she's dead either.
And in a way, it's kind of ironic because, I mean, we think of her as somebody who steered Britain considerably to the right, and yet from an American perspective, Britain still might seem like, the socialist hell that people on the right think about, in the sense that at least that it has truly socialized medicine, which is what some people on the American right would think, is beyond the point of no return to have that kind of thing. So I guess to appreciate her legacy in domestic policy, you need to have some appreciation of what Britain was like before her, which I don't have a super clear appreciation of, I guess. And you are probably too young to clearly remember that, right? When do your clear memories pick up?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was born in 1974, which was the year before she became leader of the Conservative Party. And that, of course, was an unexpected victory. And at the time, Britain was a very different place then. Obviously, in the Conservative Party, it was a very different place. It was still dominated by grandees, old white men, many of them from privileged and aristocratic backgrounds. And here was this grocer's daughter from provincial Lincolnshire daring to suggest that she could be not just leader of the Conservative Party, but leader of Prime Minister. That was almost a shocking development.
But can I just say, from an American perspective, one thing about her is she had, maybe this speaks to the crudeness of American stereotypes, but she seemed to have such an aristocratic manner herself, right?
Well, she was certainly haughty, I think you could say, and convinced that she was right. Yes, I mean, she had, her image was softened.
And what was that accent? What kind of accent? That's not like a Liverpool accent, right? What was that about?
No, well, she had quite a lot of work done on her voice. She had some voice coaching just to try and soften some of her tones and be a more convincing performer on television.
She had me fooled, I'll tell you.
But no, I mean, you're right in terms of you know, that Britain is a more, in some ways, is a more left-wing society than the United States. But that, you know, and you're right that she did not dismantle the National Health Service, nor did she, in fact, dismantle the welfare state at all. You know, the Labour spent the whole of the 1980s arguing that, you know, we have 24 hours to save the NHS and so on. But it was never actually seriously under threat. And they say the same, of course, now in David Cameron's government. But nobody is challenging the idea that healthcare should be free at the point of use. There are various other things that are you know, in the works in terms of reforming how it is delivered. But the essential principle of the NHS remains unchallenged. And it's, you know, the NHS has become a kind of secular religion, particularly for middle-class Britain. And as a result of that, you know, it is very difficult to actually do anything about it.
So what did she dismantle, or what did she change?
Well, you have to remember, in the 1970s, Britain was a basket case. People were thinking that Britain was ungovernable. The trade unions, particularly the coal miners, had essentially brought down Ted Heath's government in 1974. Inflation rarely dipped below 10% for a decade. At some points in the 1970s, it actually rose above 25%. Huge swathes of the British economy were owned and mismanaged by the state. It is quite astonishing when you look at a list of the privatizations that took place in the Thatcher era to realize just how extensive state ownership of industry and other parts of the economy was. I mean, it wasn't just British Steel. It wasn't just the mines. It wasn't just British Airways. All the utilities, gas, electricity, British Airways. The state owned a chain of hotels. The state owned.
How were they? I guess you never stayed in one.
The food was not perhaps great, shall we say. Britain in the 1970s had no sort of, you know, culinary reputation. You know, the state owned the production of sugar was nationalised. British Sugar was a state owned enterprise. There was even a firm called Pickford's, who are the most well-known removals firm. If you're moving house, you know, you call Pickford's. They were actually owned by the state.
In a lot of these realms, there was competition from the private sector. There were private sector hotels, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it wasn't East Germany.
Right.
But, you know, one of the telling things, if you look at the productivity, you know, by the time Thatcher left office, Britain was producing just as much steel as it did in 1979 when she entered office. But there were five times as many people employed by the steel industry in 1979 as there were in 1990. Now, you know, that's one isolated example of just how unproductive British industry had become, how sclerotic Britain was. You know, there were other things. You know, you couldn't take more than £500 out of the country when you went abroad. There were currency controls. You know, the country had to receive a bailout from the IMF in the mid-1970s.
So is there consensus?
You know, Britain was in decline. People, you know, Time magazine and Newsweek and so on referred to Britain as the sick man of Europe. And so, you know, there was a pervasive sense of decline, of defeat, of fatalism. And she saw her role principally as challenging that, as saying that, you know, it did not have to be this way. Britain could actually reorganize itself, reform itself, and become a leading nation in the world again. And that was really her challenge. You know, her achievements are not measured in legislation, really. If you compare her record with the Attlee government of the 1945-1950 period, which is the other significant post-war premiership, you know, Attlee's government passed an awful lot of legislation that was truly significant. They set up the National Health Service and so on. Thatcher's legislative achievements were somewhat slighter, but her impact was in getting government out of the way in many ways, and it was about changing the tone and the ambition of British politics. You know, it's quite striking. You know, actually, in 2013, it's now 34 years since Thatcher took office in 1979.
And she took office 34 years after Clement Attlee came to power in 1945, which is a neat coincidence, obviously, that you know, that these things divide so neatly in half. But really, yes, you have the Attlee era, which lasted, broadly speaking, until 1979, and since then we've been living in the Thatcher era.
So right now in England, as you work this thing through, is there kind of consensus that she helped generate prosperity, but disagreement over kind of the cost of the prosperity, in particular in terms of income inequality? Is that the argument that, okay, granted the economy as a whole got a boost, but it came at the expense of lower income people? I mean, I know that, that her pitch was kind of the opposite. It was that there's been this ruling class that has held, you know, energetic, entrepreneurial people down, and you know, this is, we want to give everyone equal opportunity. But I assume not everyone is swallowing that line right now as you work through her legacy.
No. You know, if you, there's an opinion poll produced yesterday that suggested that 50% of people felt that she had changed Britain for the better, and 34% said that she had changed Britain markedly for the worse. Now that's across the whole of the UK. In Scotland, only 23% of people felt that she'd changed Britain for the better. I suspect the numbers would be similar in the north of England and in Wales as well.
Are you in Scotland now?
Yeah.
Did I misintroduce you at the beginning?
No, not at all. You know, so her legacy is divided. You know, there will never be consensus on Margaret Thatcher, and it wasn't just because inequality rose in her during her reign. You know, the rich did. I think you could make an argument that on balance everybody actually was better off, but that the rich were more better off, if you like, than the poor. And there were large parts of the country where her impact or the impact of her policies proved disastrous. You know, and I think even her staunchest defenders should have the honesty to admit that.
And what is the most disastrous effect?
The most disastrous effect was that while British heavy industry probably had to was going to decline anyway, shipbuilding, steelworking, coal mining, large parts of manufacturing, and so were going to, the car industry were going to have to decline. They could not live on state subsidies forever. But what happened in large parts of the north of England, the west of Scotland, South Wales, was that, okay, heavy industry was essentially destroyed and nothing replaced it. It was the failure to realize that that something would have to be done to replace these lost jobs. And she, worse than that, it was that she didn't seem to care, or at least it was easy to perceive or to get the idea that she didn't really care. There was a relish with which she took on her opponents that in one sense was admirable, because some of them were you know, overmighty trades unions that needed to be curbed, that needed to be defeated. But at the same time, the relish with which she did so was seen by many people as sort of pushing their faces into the dirt, if you like, in a way that was perhaps unseemly. You know, that it wasn't just, she didn't just require victory, she required total victory. And that came at a significant cost. I mean, there are still parts of Britain that haven't really recovered from the 1980s, where, you know, the legacy of industrial decline has not been arrested. You know, the jobs haven't come to replace them, and so you have these broken communities still, where welfare dependency is a crippling blight, where and all the programs, all the things that are associated with that. So you know, while most of Britain did well under her, and many of the reforms she introduced were, I think, necessary in terms of liberalising the economy, it came at quite a significant price, and one that was terribly heavy to bear in some places. And that again is one of the reasons why she's so controversial. You know, she was not a force for unmitigated good. But there, then again, you know, the notion of her as some sort of witch is also a terrible caricature. it's a complicated legacy. You know, she wasn't a simplistic politician. Or in one way she was. I mean, she was very sure of what she knew, and she did not brook dissent terribly kindly. But, you know, she was not, you know, people talk about, you know, say her 1981 budget, which is a very famous budget, actually increased taxes. You know, she was not a Reaganite, every tax cut pays for itself type
well,
of
operative. Well, and even Reagan wound up increasing more taxes than is commonly acknowledged. Tell me about the European Union. Was she the beginning, her administration, the beginning of what became a more or less enduring British resistance to deep integration in the EU, at least, you know, deep enough to include the currency union? And in which case, I would think that's something that's been discussed lately or not.
Yeah, oh yeah, very much so. I mean, in terms of the single currency, she was right. You know, she warned that
and
the single currency...
That's a consensus. That's more or less a consensus in Britain now that she got that one right.
The constituency for British membership of the euro is tiny. You could fit them into a couple of London taxis.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, there was significant parts of the British opinion, particularly in the BBC and the Guardian, even in the large parts of the Conservative Party, or a wing of the Conservative Party, that thought Britain should join the single currency. Much of the Labour Party was in favour of it as well. But it was a combination, if you like, of Margaret Thatcher and Rupert Murdoch, who helped ensure that wouldn't happen. But even on Europe, it's complicated. It's more nuanced than the caricature would suggest. You know, in 1975, when there was a referendum, not 75, before that, there was a referendum on Britain remaining within the European Economic Community, as it was then. And most of the opposition to British membership of the EEC then actually came from the left. It was the Labour Party that was split on Europe then. Thatcher campaigned in front of banners saying Conservatives for Europe. But she saw it as a single market, and that should be it, really. A union of nation states rather than a federal union or a European superstate, which is what she greatly feared. You know, in this sense, she was actually, and in many others, actually, you know, the figure with which she's... perhaps comparable is Charles de Gaulle. She was her view of Europe was quite Gaullist, albeit she was also terribly suspicious of the French, and she was very English in that sense. The French could not be trusted.
And I would guess that one distinction was she was probably pretty wholeheartedly in favor of the reduction in trade barriers entailed by the EU, whereas the Gaullists were probably more suspicious of even that.
Yes.
And I think where she got upset was when. You started getting regulation, kind of affirmative regulation of commerce, which some people would say is entailed logically by freer trade. But anyway, leave that argument aside.
Well, it is to some degree, yes. But she, you know, she was a free marketeer. You know, that was what she believed in. And she felt really that was all that Europe needed to be. And so in that sense, yes, she had a fundamentally different vision of what Europe should be to that you find in Brussels or indeed Paris or Bonn, now Berlin. So, you know, yes, the divides over Europe ended up damaging her enormously. They were a huge part of why she was eventually toppled, defenestrated by the Conservative Party. Yeah, it was divides over Europe in many ways that cost her the support of Geoffrey Howe, who had been first Chancellor, then Foreign Secretary, and then ultimately Deputy Prime Minister. And he resigned largely over differences about Europe and the style of Thatcher's government. It was increasingly regal, intolerant of even internal dissent within the cabinet. And he delivered a devastating resignation speech in the House of Commons that's still famous to this day, and always will be, actually, when people contemplate resignation speeches. And that was the thing that then opened the room for Michael Heseltine to challenge Thatcher for the Tory party's leadership. And she was ultimately defeated. I mean, Heseltine himself didn't become leader. John Major did. But it was this this act of regicide. You know, there are still Tory MPs at Westminster who think it is too painful to talk about this period in the party's history. It was prompted by concerns over Europe and overall a fear that things had just gone too far, that she was out of touch with the British people, and that she was going to in grave danger of losing the next general election. And so the Tory party, which has always been a ruthless beast, threw her out the window before the electorate had the chance to do so. But the divisions still exist in many ways. And you're right that no subsequent Tory leader has really been able to reconcile exactly how to keep Britain a member of the European Union on its own terms. As Cameron is now promising a referendum on continuing British membership and talking about renegotiating the terms of that membership. I'm not quite sure how he can really do that, but there we are. The Tory party is now solidly Eurosceptic, but then so is, in general terms, much of British opinion. You know, the Britain wants to be a member of the EU, but it doesn't really want the EU to be anything more than just a free trade agreement.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the realm of foreign policy, a couple of things she did, and I think you could see a little irony here. She, on the one hand, gave Hong Kong back to China, or at least arranged for that to happen.
She didn't have any choice in that. It was a treaty. We only had a 99-year lease on Hong Kong.
So, okay, was that due to expire in 1997? Okay, so there was no choice there.
No. Why? No, sadly not.
So what was actually negotiated? There was something negotiated, just how exactly it would do, the change of hands would take place?
Yeah, and what we saw in her years was moves to actually establish something akin to a proper democratic system of governance for Hong Kong in the hope that the Chinese would not then dismantle that.
Which is to some extent, I guess, Hong Kong remains kind of an outlier.
Yeah.
It's culturally distinct from...
Yeah.
And you could argue has had what we in the West would call a positive influence on China more than China has had a negative influence on it. I don't know.
I think so. But then, that's capitalism.
Yeah. That is capitalism. So anyway, in terms of things she did not give back to countries, there is the Falkland Islands.
Yeah.
What's that?
Her finest hour.
A war that I've heard compared to two bald men fighting over a comb. I mean, the actual islands are not like a major asset, right?
No. But she saw it in very principled terms that the people of the Falkland Islands, which is British territory and recognized as such by international law, there is no doubt of that, were and wished to remain British.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, for her, it was a simple matter of principle. Two principles. One, upholding British sovereignty. And secondly, upholding international law, that the Argentine invasion was something that was intolerable, and so she dispatched a task force to retake the islands, was quite an adventure. They're 8,000 miles away, and this was, in the era before you had stealth bombers that could fly to the other side of the world.
I think it was, if I'm recalling correctly, I think it was almost the debut, at least the of any prominence, of kind of smart weapons. I believe the British were using these French Exocet missiles, or
No. That was the Argentinians who were using the French Exocet missiles.
Oh, really?
To sink a number of British ships, yeah.
So the British used torpedoes to do the whatever it was, the Belgrado or Belgrano or whatever?
The Belgrano was Argentine battleship, was a battlecruiser, was sunk controversially.
So the Argentinians had the smart weapons.
But, well, no, it wasn't so much that they had smart weapons, but they had a number of French Exocet missiles, missiles that they had bought from the French. They hadn't been supplied to them by the French here's some assistance while you're battling perfidious Albion. In actual fact, the French were very useful allies to Britain behind the scenes during the Falklands conflict.
Okay.
But it was a big gamble. She was not on her own in taking it, but there were senior members of the cabinet, and indeed even within the armed forces, that were not sure that this was the thing to do. The American administration, the Reagan administration, was very skeptical about it initially. Alexander Haig, felt that this was a misguided adventure. Jean Patrick, who was at the United Nations, I think still at the United Nations at the time, was essentially pro-Argentine. Reagan himself was a little wobbly on it until he received a stern talking to, and then the United States did supply behind the scenes support as well.
And it was a huge political winner in Britain,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. It transformed her prospects in some respects. I mean, there'd been a damaging and deep recession. There'd been a lot of rioting in the inner cities in London and Birmingham and Liverpool. The country was not in the happiest of places, and then the Falklands War became a great rallying point. She was fortunate in some ways as well. I mean, the opposition was terribly divided in 1983 at the 1983 election, which followed soon after the war. The Labour Party produced a manifesto that was reasonably labelled the longest suicide note in political history. And that obviously helped turn but the Falklands War was a key turning point, not just in terms of winning the war, and that was a notable achievement, because obviously if Britain had lost or it had gone disastrously wrong, then that would have been the end of her. But because it had other consequences as well. After it, she had a new confidence, a new certainty, which, given that she had not previously been noted for her lack of confidence or lack of certainty, was quite something. She became even more convinced that she was right. In many of her reforms actually then came after the Falklands War. Her great battle with the mine unions, the mine workers, the National Union of Miners, came after the Falklands War, and was seen then within the government and externally as being, if you like, a domestic version of the Falklands War, that the miners had to be broken. That was a battle that lasted a year. It was immensely divisive and difficult and controversial and brutal. For which many people on the left have yet to forgive her. And I think even her admirers have to admit that although it was necessary to tame the mining unions, the manner in which it was done was quite regrettable in some respects, or at least it certainly had some adverse consequences.
What should she have done differently?
She could have gone more slowly in some ways, but then her hand was forced to some degree, because the miners called an illegal strike. They cut their own throats in some ways. Again, she was lucky that the miners' leaders were so remarkably stupid.
The Reagan parallel of roughly the same time, I guess, is of course the airport workers who were. Mm-hmm. Who were for being government, whose strike was inherently illegal because they were not, they were a particular kind of worker, and the deal was they were not supposed to strike.
Yeah.
That happened a lot faster, but it left a certain amount of bitterness.
Yeah, I mean, it was a turning point, certainly, in Reagan's administration, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Their relationship was quite odd, of course, because, again, they're both recalled as these titans, and in some respects that's reasonable. But there is a new fascination with Thatcher, certainly within the Tory party. But there isn't quite the same, the answer to any given question is to ask, what would Margaret have done? And then divine from that, well, this is what we should do. There is, I think, perhaps a slightly greater appreciation in the Conservative Party that this is not actually 1979 anymore than there is in the Republican Party, for whom the cult of Reagan, although perhaps not quite as strong as it was a few years ago remains, I think, extraordinarily strong, doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, my sense is almost that Thatcher's death is a bigger deal in Britain than Reagan's death was here, although it was a pretty big deal. But I don't know. The relationship was interesting. What are they saying there? I mean, one thing that I think Reagan is falsely credited with here is, like, ending the Cold War. What are they, and I could elaborate on why I think that's not the case, but what are they saying about Thatcher's role in that same event?
Well, I think, I mean, I would agree with you that you know, put it this way, if you say that Reagan and Thatcher ended the Cold War, then that's fine. But they couldn't have done it without Gorbachev, there was a reason beyond the fact that the Nobel people doubtless considered Reagan and Thatcher politically unsound. But there is a reason why Gorbachev got the Nobel Prize and they did not. No Gorbachev, no ending of the Cold War. Whereas it might have ended.
Well, or not a graceful ending, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe I should elaborate on why I think Reagan is falsely credited. You know, I was. If any empire was ever destined to collapse sooner or later, you know, I mean, I was in Russia during the very early Gorbachev years, so I was kind of seeing what economy he had inherited. And I went to the finest department store in what is now called St. Petersburg. I think maybe then it was still called Leningrad. I'm not sure. And you would go to the home appliance section where we would find washing machines, and all they had was washing boards. I mean, really, and you would go to where we would buy TVs, and behind their glass counters, what you would see is like vacuum tubes that people would buy to go repair their own TVs with vacuum tubes, you know, well after we had progressed into the solid state era of electronics. I mean, this place, you couldn't get, like, on any given day, you just might wake up and find there was no milk available. I mean, it was incredible. There were the longest lines to get the most meager foodstuffs. It was incredible. And that's why I just think it's like, you know, the idea that we had to invade Grenada or something, you know, to really push them over the edge.
Well, Thatcher
they
was
were
furious,
doomed. They were
course,
doomed.
Thatcher was furious with Reagan when he invaded Grenada. It was one of the things he had a row about. Yeah, because Grenada was a Commonwealth country, former British colony, and the Americans had invaded without even a phone call to the UK to say that this is what we're going to do. Her Majesty the Queen was also, it is believed, displeased by this. And also, Grenada? it was a preposterous piece of adventurism. But Thatcher's importance in terms of Gorbachev and Reagan was that she was probably the first to say, as she said after one of her initial meetings with Gorbachev, this is a man with whom we can do business.
Right.
And that was important because it helped, I think, give Reagan some space when confronting the hawks within in Washington. That, you know, actually, well, you know, if Thatcher says that, you know, this is a guy we should talk to and interesting things may be about to happen, then, you know, then this is not a crazy, you know, peacenik liberal kind of notion or agenda. So I think that was one of her important roles. Her foreign policy record is quite mixed. She was right about the Soviet Union. She was right about Gorbachev. She is still seen in Poland and the Czech Republic and so on, or at least by conservatives in Poland and the Czech Republic, as being a great heroine, one of the people who certainly helped end the Cold War. Against that, she was badly wrong on South Africa. Her friendship with Pinochet in Chile was unfortunate.
Yeah.
But that was at least in part because Pinochet had been had offered assistance during the Falklands War. So there was a reason for that. But against that, you know, her victory in the Falklands War also, I think, helped bring down the military junta in Argentina, and that in turn, I think, helped make. Helped spell the end for military dictatorships in other parts of Latin America as well. It helped demonstrate how they were not the answer. So that was perhaps, if you like, an unintended consequence of her foreign policy, but it was part of it. It's mixed, like all of her legacy.
I think there's a kind of coherence to it in the sense that although she is often depicted as this fearless champion of liberty, she was in many ways a realist in foreign policy.
Yes.
And this business of we can do business with Mr. Gorbachev is actually a good example of that. You know, she said explicitly, look, he's, you know, the guy's not a Democrat, okay?
He's the best we've got.
He's got his system of government.
Than anyone else
we've got have. Ours. Yeah. That's classic realism.
Yeah. She was not a neoconservative.
And the same with South Africa, with Chile, whatever. I mean, she may have turned out to bet badly on them, but it was, again, a case where she wasn't going to pass any judgments. You know, it's like...
Yeah.
So that's kind of the irony, and I don't know, is it being appreciated in Britain that actually she was just a realist and she was very selective in her advocacy of freedom on the international stage?
Well, selective in her advocacy, I think, is putting it a little unfairly. I think she was very much in favor of these things in areas where she felt she could do something about it. She was less concerned by it in parts of the world where she felt there was no material British interest and, frankly, very little that Britain could actually do. So Suharto in Indonesia is an example of the latter camp. In Europe and other places and so on, where British concerns were more intimately involved, she did have a useful impact, I think. Mm-hmm. So you could say selective, but I think I'd prefer what you previously said, realist. She was not a utopian in that respect.
No.
Politics and leadership is complicated and often paradoxical.
And
she was no exception to that.
One ideal you might be able to say she did fairly consistently stand up for, and this is actually not uncharacteristic of realists often, is actually international law.
Yeah.
Another thing she's given...
Kuwait.
I was going to bring up Kuwait. I mean, that was a violation of international law. It was transborder aggression. It was ultimately addressed in a manner consistent with international law, that is, through the Security Council, which...
She was keen that it should go through the Security Council.
Right, and she is credited with putting Steele and George Bush's spine on that.
Again,
I think there's a chance that he might not have done anything about it had she not intervened. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, again, she saw this as being, you know, like the Falklands in one respect, just as an act of aggression contrary to international law and justice, two not being exactly the same things, and that it could not be allowed to stand because it would set an appalling. It would not just be a betrayal of the people, of the victims of this aggression, but it would set an appalling precedent. International law meant something to her. I mean, you know, again, she was complicated. I mean, she towards the end of her career, she attended, I think it was something called a World Climate Conference or something. This was in 1990, and delivered a speech stressing the importance of both recognizing climate change and taking steps to address it. This is not something that you associate with conservatives. Especially American conservatives, of course. It was a view that she felt that something ought to be done, and it was better to be cautious or to take a view that prudence really demanded that we take measures to counteract the potential consequences of global warming and climate change, even if... some of those consequences failed to play out, that we should insure against the worst, essentially. She saw herself, and that was in some ways consistent with her view. She believed herself to be an advocate of prudence and decency and common sense and, in some ways, risk aversion, albeit there was the radical free market side to her as well. So, you know, she contained multitudes, like most of the great politicians, certainly those who are worth devoting an episode of Blogging Heads to.
Yes, and we don't do it often, and we always wait till they die.
Let
me close with this question, which just occurred to me, actually. which is what she would have thought of the war launched by George Bush's son, the Iraq War, which contrasts with the Persian Gulf War in at least two senses. First of all, there was no such clear-cut violation of international law by Iraq that triggered it. I mean, you can argue how fully in compliance he was with UN resolutions, but by letting the inspectors in and look wherever they wanted, he was, like, I would say, easily more than 90% in compliance. And he had done nothing like what he had done when he invaded Kuwait, A. And B, of course, the war was not legitimized through the proper channels of international law, namely the Security Council. Have you ever thought, like, what would she have thought of that war? Because, of course, the prime minister you wound up with loved it, at least at the beginning.
Well, yeah. I think it's a difficult question. I mean, there are some people who say that if she'd remained prime minister in 1990, you know, because I mean, she was toppled in that period between Saddam invading Kuwait and Operation Desert Storm commencing. John Major was actually prime minister at the time of the war, the hot war, the 4 days of it. There are people who suggest that had she remained in power, she might have pressed the Americans to move beyond the war's initial aims and head to Baghdad, and that we had to get rid of Saddam. But I think that's one of those things that we just, you know, can't say. We don't know. As for the second Gulf War, again, I mean, she would have been. Afghanistan would have been an easy call for her, and would have remained so. The Second Gulf War, I really don't know, to be honest. I suspect that she would have ended up supporting it had she been in power at the time, and so on.
Out of regard for the special relationship with America?
I think so, and I think that it is certainly possible that she would have viewed, as Blair did, that September 11th, the nature of it, the scale of it, and scale matters in these things, had shifted the overall calculus, that risks that were previously... risks that you could previously live with were now not so, it was no longer so comfortable to live with them. I can see that she might have taken that view as well. But, you know, it's a fairly imponderable question.
You had the chance there to convert me into a big Margaret Thatcher fan by affirming that she definitely would have opposed the Iraq War, but
she might have, but I mean, I really don't know.
Late.
I mean, she was not very good at gazing into other people's souls, and I'm not sure how useful it is to gaze into hers in respect to this, at least.
She would not have looked into Putin's eyes and said, as George Bush the younger did, I have seen into his soul, or whatever the hell ridiculous thing he said.
I think we can be pretty sure that she would not have done so.
She might have said we can do business with him, but she would not have said...
She would not have approved of Mr. Putin either, I think. And, you know, I mean, Thatcher was, you know, she, again, a complicated character. I mean, she was... there was a great a line that somebody came up with the other day that, you know, she had hoped that Britain would be like her father, who was an alderman, a local government, a councillor in provincial Lincolnshire in Grantham, where she grew up and where she was born. You know, God-fearing, Methodist, hard-working, prudent, thrifty. And instead, you know, she hoped that Britain would be in her father's image, essentially. And then... thanks in large part to some of the policies she pursued, deregulation of the financial sector, for instance, which transformed London, made London once again a global capital for finance, rivaling New York, having spent 20 or 30 years being eclipsed by New York. Instead, you know, Britain ended up being rather like her son, somewhat feckless, spendthrift, playboy with dodgy associations in other parts of the world. You know, and in some ways, her vision of what Britain should be is not how Britain has turned out to be. The consequences of her premiership, both in terms of economic terms and socially, have not been what she would have foreseen. I mean, she was an economic liberal, but a social conservative. And I'm not sure that she ever really appreciated the tension between those two things. The economic
economic liberalism spawns social liberalism as well, I think.
The contradictions of capitalism.
Yeah, and so, you know, her legacy is a Britain that is more relaxed in many ways, kinder mm-hmm. in some ways, certainly a more tolerant place, but also multicolored, polyglot, multi-religious mm-hmm. in some ways. Well, the Christianity is in decline, but other religions are thriving. You know, that it is a very different place to that of 1979, which looks quite monochrome in comparison to Britain today. And many of those developments she would not have welcomed. You know, they are part of her legacy as well. I mean, she in the late 60s, she voted in favor of decriminalizing homosexuality, which was, you know, quite courageous for a conservative MP to do at the time. Mm-hmm. But she would not, it is difficult to believe that she would have been in favor of gay marriage. And she certainly would not have been in favor of large-scale immigration.
Although almost no one who's in favor of it now was in favor of it back then, you know?
Well, no, that's true. That's
you
true.
Never know.
But, you know, she, you know, her great mission was defeating socialism at home and, mm-hmm. and abroad, of course, in some ways. And in that she prevailed. But in doing so, you know, in the triumph of market liberalism had unintended or unforeseen consequences in terms of the social arena, many of which I think she would have disapproved mm-hmm. of, but that are actually a large part of her legacy.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for all these insights, Alex. I will leave you to work through the remaining stages of your grief. I hope I've helped. I hope this has been cathartic or something.
Oh, yeah. No, it's been fun. I mean, she, you know, one of the things that you see is a slight sense of awe about her, even on the left. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. the celebrations
of
her demise have been rather more muted than some people expected or anticipated. And I think that's just because, you know, she remains a divisive figure, but she is a figure of such consequence of a sort that we don't actually see all that often. Mm-hmm. You know, you can argue that the, you know, four most consequential British prime ministers of the 20th century were David Lloyd George, Clement Attlee, Winston Churchill, and Margaret Thatcher. You know, so we don't have these sorts of people coming around all that often. You know, none of her successors have faced challenges anything like as daunting or as significant or as vital as those she did. And so they are still, you know, the Thatcherite shadow still casts itself over British politics. I mean, we are still in the era of Thatcher. It may be drawing to an end, but we certainly don't know what comes next. But, you know, if we had the era of Attlee from 45 to 79, 79 to 2013 is certainly the age of Thatcher.
And we're about due for a new age, but we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks again, Alex. And I hope you won't wait until the next death of an epic figure to come back.
No, well, I mean, I hope not. Anytime.
Okay.
Yeah.
Take care.
Excellent. Thank you, Bob.